From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, geoengineering. Here's what's happening. The federal government will not mandate the use of vaccine passports for travelers. President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has made this claim. Why does it matter? Well, passports showing proof of vaccination could speed up international travel reopenings, but the idea of requiring immunization credentials has become a point of contention among a lot of people. But so far, it's not going to happen. The United States is now averaging about 3.1 million COVID-19 vaccines administered per day, according to White House officials, although Dr. Rochelle Walensky has expressed concerns about rising trends elsewhere. According to the latest Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data, there has been a 7% increase in daily cases, amounting to an average of about 64,000. And how could that be with so many vaccines out there in the system? It's strange, isn't it? Walgreens is shifting its Pfizer COVID-19 vaccination scheduling after federal health officials noted the pharmacy chain quietly decided to space the doses apart over a longer-than-recommended period. The federal guidelines call for the two-dose series to be administered at least 21 days apart, but Walgreens pushed the spacing to 4 weeks for easier logistics. The feds say no, no, no. Americans can expect to receive more cell phone robocalls and texts. Well, that's just what we need because of a U.S. Supreme Court decision in a unanimous ruling that could have a major impact on telemarketing. The Supreme Court ruled that Facebook cannot be sued for repeatedly texting customers security alerts because its text did not come from an auto dialer. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court also has handed Google a win in a decade-old case in software development, holding that the technology giant did not commit copyright infringement against Oracle when it copied snippets of programming language to build its Android operating system. What does this all mean? Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet. Lauren, what's this story mean?
Yeah, well, actually, it's interesting that we've had two Supreme Court rulings of interest at the same time, that robocall one you mentioned. And by the way, the really interesting part about that, other than the fact it's anonymous, right? I wish it was anonymous. It's unanimous. Very, very special that we can get more robocalls now. It's a 30-year-old law that they're interpreting there. And the key part of that law is where it says, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, is that it only applies to robocalls where random numbers or sequential numbers are being used, not stored databases of numbers. So, of course, that just tells robocallers, spammers, what they need to do. They need to be using databases of numbers. And while we still have the Do Not Call list, we know how ineffective that is. There are some state laws still, and there are, you know, obviously fraudulent calls are still illegal. But really, people need to get on the case with their representatives to fill this loophole. And I think there's some efforts in that direction already starting up. Now, the Google one, that case between Google and Oracle that was decided 6-2, has been going on for about a decade now in various courts over the Oracle's Java language API and the way Google used it in Android. And the thing is, it's technical, but the bottom line is that APIs, the application programming interfaces, are really crucial to the development and operation of all manner of software and hardware systems. So this ruling now says that those interfaces can be utilized under fair use to develop other code. So this is a big win, but not just for Google, but also for open software and consumers in general. Because if that ruling had gone the other way, it would have really put brakes on all manner of software development and could have dramatically raised costs and prices along the way. So it's been a mixed bag from the Supreme Court over the last few days, to be sure.
Okay, in 2 weeks, we're going to have you for a full couple hours. Are you ready for that?
Oh, definitely. Always
all right.
Fun.
Super. Thanks, Lauren. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on such matters. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a law that could keep him in office in the Kremlin until 2036. That would make him 84 when he leaves office. I think he wants to stay forever. What's going on in the skies these days? It's that time for Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen. What do you got for us?
Hello, George. Space fans, as you would imagine, all over the world are excited, very excited, for the first Ingenuity helicopter flight on Mars. George, this may happen as early as sometime this week, April the 8th, maybe. And that time, this particular little craft will launch into the thin Martian atmosphere. Get a load of this. The rotor blades have to spin at an incredible 2,537 RPM to launch this little craft from its 33-foot by 33-foot airfield. But, George, other exciting news looms in space, too. Get ready for the NASA Discovery Program's next mission to an asteroid. This mission is known as Psyche, headed in 2022 to the unique asteroid by the same name, the Greek goddess of the soul, wife to Eros. And the mission will explore one of the most unique asteroids, George, in the entire solar system. We know asteroids are made up of many metallic substances and rocks and such, but this is a real true metallic asteroid, 140 miles wide, probably the core of an ancient planet. 16 Psyche was discovered back in 1852, the 16th asteroid ever discovered in the numerical count, with a mass of, get a load of this, some 440 billion, billion pounds. I don't know how the heck they figure that. But the Psyche mission will launch in August of 2022, and arrive in 2026. But in astronomy, George, one of the most beautiful planets, we watch it all the time, Saturn.
Love it.
And it's most amazing ring system. But here's some facts about what's happening on Saturn. Its ring system was thought to be discovered by Galileo, but it actually wasn't. It was ID'd back in the year 1655 by the astronomer Christian Huygens. He actually discovered the rings. But there's seven major ring divisions. We know this for sure. Get a load of this. The closest of the rings orbit at some 52,000 miles per hour around Saturn, and the outermost at some 37,000 miles per hour, like a mini solar system, made up of tiny ice particles up to SUV-sized rocks. And if you unfurled the rings, George, they would have a mass of only 1/5,000th the mass of the moon. Saturn is slowly swallowing up its rings, and sad to say, in the long-distant future, some 300 million years in the future, Saturn will be ringless. The live sky, we wrap it up. George, this is International Dark Sky Week. Did you know that some 80% of the world's population naturally lives in urban light pollution? They never get to see the beauty of the dark skies required to see the Milky Way. Yeah. This is our arm of the galaxy. This week offers us a great chance to get out and visit some urban sky areas for city dwellers, and people in the country know all too well that they can see it, as the moon, George, will become a waning crescent later this week, and new moon on the 12th makes it the best time to view in a dark sky. For planets, Mars is still high in the west at sunset, about 170 million miles from your eye. Jupiter and Saturn low in the east at dawn, and at sunset, so we talked about the Milky Way, here's how to see it. It stretches from the north, then low into the northwest sky, then moving to the southwest, an amazing sight to see. Of course, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Always more information at theskylive.com, and email me. We love those, George. DrSkyShow@gmail.com. Simply your navigator on the highway to the heavens, and glad to be a part of the team.
Always good talking to you, Dr. Sky. We'll talk to you next Monday. Is science trying to determine how intelligent design may have created the universe? In a moment, Stephen Meyer back with us. Return of the God Hypothesis, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. We've got a stunning couple hours here for you. Stephen Meyer back with us. Dr. Meyer received his PhD from the University of Cambridge in the Philosophy of Science Department, a former geophysicist and college professor. He directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. 2004, he ignited a firestorm of media and scientific controversy when a biology journal at the Smithsonian Institution published his peer-reviewed scientific article, Advancing the Theory of Intelligent Design. His latest book is called Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Stephen, very thorough job with this work, by the way. Congratulations.
Yeah, great to be with you again.
How have you been?
Very well, although a little tired after finishing this one, but it's awfully good to have it off to the press.
It is a thorough book. It really is. How long have you been working on it?
This one was a 3.5-year project.
That's a long time for a book, isn't it?
It's longer than I meant it to be, but it's done, so that's good.
Any controversy?
Not so far. I'm sure there will be, but I think there's actually a shift taking place, and that's part of the story of the book, that more and more scientists are realizing that there are these very fundamental questions that a completely materialistic approach to science doesn't answer. The origin of the universe being perhaps the most important, but also how the universe acquired its exquisite fine-tuning that makes life possible in the universe. And finally, the third big discovery I examine in the book is the discovery of the digital code in the molecules at the foundation of life, the information stored in the DNA molecule that makes even the simplest living cells tick. So the Big Bang, the fine-tuning, and the discovery of digital code, I think, are awakening a lot of scientists to a new perspective, and that's what the story of the book is about, the return of the God hypothesis.
I spend so much time, especially at night, sometimes after the show, I'll go outside, Stephen, and look at the night sky. And I got to tell you, there's so much order to this universe. It's almost as if this entire universe is a puzzle and all the pieces fit together. Now, that doesn't happen randomly, does it?
Well, that was certainly the perspective of the early scientists who invented what we call the modern scientific method, and who first began to investigate science, or who investigate nature in a systematic way, thinking of people like Johannes Kepler and Galileo and Robert Boyle, and especially Sir Isaac Newton, in the theological epilogue that Newton wrote to his great work, the Principia, called The General Scholium. He wrote that this most beautiful system of planets, sun, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. And it was this perspective that of design, the perception of design in the universe, was a very powerful impetus to starting science. And we're now coming back to that after a departure from that perspective that I think began in the late 19th century.
I was raised a Catholic, Stephen, and of course they taught us the biblical perspective of God and the formation of the universe and all that. And it was acceptable to me. I have to be very honest with you and everybody else. I don't know what it is. I mean, I believe in intelligent design without a doubt. I just don't know what it is. So tell us your thoughts, your theory of what intelligent design, first of all, might
be. Well, the straightforward scientific theory of intelligent design is based on some new methods of design detection that have been used. They were first perhaps pioneered in fields like forensic science and cryptography. It turns out we humans detect the effects of intelligence. We detect intelligence in the echo of the effects they leave behind all the time. If we look at a road sign or a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book, we know that an intelligence was behind that. One example that we often use is the faces on Mount Rushmore. If you take a look at those faces, you immediately know that it wasn't wind and erosion that carved those faces. There was an artist or an artisan involved, maybe several. And there have been some advances in fields like complexity theory and probability theory that have enabled us to codify exactly how it is that we detect design. And in my first two books, I showed that the indicators of design, one of the crucial indicators being functional information, especially the functional information we find in a digital form at the foundation of life in molecules like DNA and RNA, that those molecules are exhibiting the indicators of design that we would in any other realm of experience attribute to an intelligent agent. If you found a hieroglyphic inscription in a cave or information in an old parchment, you would know that a mind played a role. But we found information at the foundation of life, and not only just information, but a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that bears all the hallmarks of high-tech digital computing. So we clearly have evidence of intelligence or mind in living systems. And that was the argument that I made in the first two books. But after writing that, many of my readers wanted to know, well, who do you think that intelligence is, and what can science tell us about that question? And that's what this new book addresses.
Tell us about the title, Return of the God Hypothesis.
Right. Well, as I said, in the early period known as the Scientific Revolution, from roughly 1500 to 1750, the early scientists brought to their their investigation of nature, a theological perspective.
And all they had working for them was their mind, because they had no equipment.
Yeah, not too much. A little bit of telescope action, but not too much.
Not much.
Nothing like what Dr. Skye has.
Exactly.
Before, you know. But in any case, it was assumed that nature was intelligible, and that there was, because it had been made by a rational intellect, namely God, the same God who had made our minds in his image that allowed us to use our rationality to perceive the rationality, the design, and the order that had been built into nature. And then, so they had a watchword. They said, nature is intelligible, and it can be understood by scientific inquiry. Johannes Kepler said, we scientists have the high calling of thinking God's thoughts after him. But that perspective was lost in the late 19th century with the rise of Darwin, Marx, Freud, other figures, Thomas Henley Huxley. But I'm arguing in this book it's coming back, and at least it should be coming back because of the things we've discovered. Not only have we discovered the code at the foundation of life, but in this new book, what I do is I broaden the exploration to examine cosmology and astrophysics and physics itself, and look at two other key discoveries, namely that the universe, as best we can tell, had a beginning. The physical universe itself had a beginning. And from the beginning, the universe has been finely tuned to allow for the possibility of life. And when we look at the evidence of design at the very beginning of the universe, that's not the kind of design that could be explained by any being or entity within the cosmos. That seems to require a transcendent designer, a designer who is separate from the cosmos and who could bring the universe into existence at the beginning and to structure it in such a way that would make life possible. So with the first book, I argued for a designer of some kind, but in this book, I eliminate by process of evaluating the adequacy of an alternative theory, namely some immanent designer, some scientists, even Francis Crick and Richard Dawkins have proposed that there may be a designing intelligence at work in bringing life to Earth, but it must have been intelligence that evolved within the cosmos. And I argue in this book that the evidence of design from the very beginning in the parameters of physics that make all life possible preclude that explanation, because no being within the cosmos could explain the fine-tuning of the laws of physics that make its very existence possible, especially when that fine-tuning precedes the origin and evolution of any possible life form in the cosmos or on Earth.
Well, Stephen, you brought up Richard Dawkins, the British biologist, noted author. He's 80 years old. He seems to tip towards intelligent design, doesn't he?
Well, he's always been a staunch advocate of strict materialism and the neo-Darwinian idea that life looks like it's designed, but it's not really designed because an undirected, unguided process has produced everything. But in one of his books, he said he made a very provocative and important statement. He says the universe has precisely the properties we should expect to see. If at bottom there's no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, which is a shorthand for strictly materialistic processes, no mind or intention. Now, a few years ago, when interviewed in a film called Expelled, he wobbled on that a little bit when Ben Stein got him to acknowledge that there is no adequate evolutionary explanation for the origin of the first life. And Stein asked him, well, what do you think then there's the probability that some intelligent design might have played a role? And Dawkins speculated in the interview that, well, maybe there was a kind of signature, or there is a signature of intelligence in life, but the intelligence must be some alien intelligence that has itself evolved by undirected natural processes. And I take that proposal head on in this book and show that that's not plausible when we consider, first of all, you still have to explain the origin of the information that would make the evolutionary process possible, and information always comes from a mind, a pre-existing mind. But secondly, the universe has been fine-tuned from the very beginning to make all life and even the evolution of life possible. So no being within the cosmos could explain the fine-tuning which precedes its origin.
After the return of the God hypothesis, you talk about three scientific discoveries that you say will reveal the mind behind the universe. What are those three discoveries?
Right. The first is the one I discussed in my first two books, Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt, and that is that inside even the simplest living cells, we have information in a digital form. This was the great discovery of first Watson and Crick, and then Crick in developing what he called the sequence hypothesis, that the characters, the chemical subunits in DNA are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written language, or like the zeros and ones, the digital characters in the section of software. fact, our local hero here in the Seattle area, Bill Gates, says that the DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever created. We know from experience that software comes from programmers, and in fact, whenever we find information, whether in a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or even embedded in a radio signal, it always comes from a mind, not a material process. That's discovery number one, information in even the simplest living cells. Second discovery is the discovery that the laws and constants of physics, the basic parameters of physics that govern our universe, have been finely tuned to make life possible.
Hold on for a second, Stephen. We'll come back and hit on that number two and get number three from you when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls next hour with Stephen Meyer as we talk about his latest work, Return of the God Hypothesis. It's an amazing story about the existence of the universe and intelligent design. It's fantastic. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Stephen Meyer with us. We will take calls with Stephen next hour. Stephen, so we're talking about the three discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. The first, you talked about cells and information within those cells. Go ahead with number two.
Second big discovery is in the realm of physics, and that is the discovery that the basic parameters of physics, the strength of the fundamental laws like gravitation or electromagnetism, the precise speed of light, the weight of the elementary particles or the masses of the elementary particles, the expansion rate of the universe or the force that's causing that expansion, all of these different physical parameters and forces have to fall within very fine limits or tolerances to make it possible for there to be life or even basic chemistry in the universe. And as a result, many physicists now refer to the universe as a kind of the Goldilocks universe, the expansion rate of the universe that we now know about. One of the things that helped us discover the Big Bang is precisely calibrated. If it were a little faster, a little slower, and if the force producing it were a little stronger, a little weaker, then we wouldn't get stable galaxies. We'd have, in one case, a collapse of the universe.
Sure.
In another case, what's called a heat death. And the fine-tuning of that one parameter, what's called the cosmological constant, is 1 part in 10 to the 90th power. To put that in perspective, there are only 10 to the 80th elementary particles in the entire universe. So to get that level of fine-tuning right by chance would be like a blind man going out on a spaceship in the middle of the cosmos looking for one elementary particle, but not just in our universe, but in 10 billion universes our size. It's an exquisite degree of precision and fine-tuning that makes life possible. And one of the great physicists who first discovered some of these parameters, Sir Fred Hoyle, great British astrophysicist, formerly an atheist, was quoted as saying, "The evidence we have suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry to make life possible." So that's the second big discovery, sometimes just called the fine-tuning or the cosmic fine-tuning.
Number three?
Number three is actually the discovery of the Big Bang, the discovery that the universe itself had, as best we can tell, a beginning. And I was enjoying the little segment from Dr. Sky before I came on the air, and he was talking about the Milky Way galaxy. And prior to 1920, just 100 years ago, astronomers didn't know if there were any other galaxies beyond our own Milky Way. But in 1924, Edwin Hubble, the great astronomer from Caltech, was able to measure the distance to the Andromeda galaxy and determined that it was 900,000 light years away, and yet the entire scope of the Milky Way thought to be about 300,000 light years. So clearly there were other galaxies, but the most important thing he discovered was that as he surveyed the night sky, almost all of the galaxies were exhibiting what's called a red shift, that the light coming from those galaxies was being stretched out, indicating that the galaxies were actually receding from us, and that suggested a spherical expansion of the universe in all directions. And if that's very interesting, living in an expanding universe. But what's even more interesting is to think about where we would have been 1,000 years ago, 1,000,000 years ago, 1,000,000,000 years ago. As you go back in time and wind that clock back in your mind's eye, all those galaxies would have been closer and closer and closer together in the reverse direction of time until finally they would have congealed to a starting point, the beginning of the expansion and arguably the beginning of the universe itself. And the first hint of this came in the 1920s, first with some of Hubble's discoveries, but also with Einstein's theory of general relativity, which had the same implication of a dynamic expanding universe. And then there have been a series of discoveries over the last 100 years that have provided additional evidence for the conclusion that the universe had a beginning. And if the universe itself, which contains all matter, space, time, and energy, had a beginning, then clearly no materialistic explanation would suffice, because prior to the origin of matter, there would have been no matter to cause the universe to come into existence. Before the origin of the physical universe, no physical explanation would have sufficed, because there was no physics before we got the universe going. So this pointed to the need for a cause that transcends or is separate from the universe and is separate from matter, space, time, and energy, is essentially an immaterial transcendent cause. And when you couple that with the discovery of the fine-tuning, that suggests a transcendent cause which is also intelligent or personal in that sense. And I think those two discoveries, plus the discovery of the digital code, give a very interesting profile of the designer responsible for life in the universe. The designer must be transcendent, must be personal and intelligent, and also must be active in the creation. So not as simply a deistic God who gets things going at the beginning, not a space alien who comes on long down the timeline, but rather a transcendent intelligence that is active in the creation, an agent that has the attributes that Jews, Christians, and other traditional theists have always ascribed to God. Thus the title of my book, Return of the God Hypothesis.
Stephen, I'm going to ask you, as I ask every physicist, astrophysicist who comes on this program, to try to explain to me what the Big Bang is.
Well, the Big Bang is really many people think it's the cause of the origin of the universe, but the Big Bang is actually the first event, the first effect. And it is a consequence. Our belief in a beginning to the universe, which is what the Big Bang refers to, is a consequence of several lines of evidence. First is the stretching out of the light that's coming from these distant galaxies. You may know that from science class, if you shine light through a prism, it will separate into colors, red to violet. The red light corresponds to light that has longer wavelengths, and so objects that are moving away are going to have longer wavelengths, indicating that the light is being stretched as the object moves away from us, much like the Doppler shift. And then there are many other lines of evidence, the discovery of something called the cosmic background radiation, which is the very low-level radiation left over from the first microseconds after the beginning, when all of the matter would have been condensed into a hot, almost infinitely dense state. So those are two of the key evidences that have allowed scientists to infer that a beginning took place. So the Big Bang is simply a shorthand way of talking about that event from which everything else came. But what caused the beginning is something that is necessarily requires deeper philosophical deliberation. And the one theory that doesn't make sense to explain the origin of the universe is one that postulates a prior material state, because it's matter and energy and even space and time that first come into existence. So to explain the origin of the universe, we need to posit a cause which transcends those four domains of matter, space, time, and energy. So we're looking for a transcendent cause and one that is capable of initiating something new, initiating a change of state. That sounds an awful lot like a mind, and one which is beyond the universe. And then when you couple that with the idea and the discovery that the universe has been fine-tuned from the very beginning, the fine-tuning implies a fine-tuner, an intelligent agent. So you're looking, I think, from these evidences of physics and cosmology at a transcendent intelligence who is then also active in the creation down the line when we see the origin of life and biological information.
What was before the beginning?
Well, that's the very difficult question that really can't be answered from within the framework of physics, because part of Einstein's theory of general relativity, which was his new theory of gravity that he published in 1915, is that space and time are connected. And when you get back, there were some physicists, first in the 1920s, but then in the 1960s and 70s, Stephen Hawking, Roger Penrose, George Ellis, who solved Einstein's famous equations. They were called the field equations. And the math is difficult, but the intuitions are pretty easy to follow. Hawking was thinking about this expanding universe idea. He was working on black holes, A black hole is a place where the density of matter is so intense that gravity is curving space so tightly, and this was Einstein's idea, that massive bodies curve space, that a black hole is a place where matter is curved so is so dense that matter's the space is curved so tightly that not even light can get out. Hawking started thinking about that in relation to the origin of the universe, and he realized that as you went back in time, the galaxies would be getting closer and closer together, so the matter would be becoming more and more dense, which means the space would be getting more and more tightly curved, and eventually you'd reach a limiting case where the curvature of space would go to an infinite corresponding to zero spatial volume, and at that point both space and time began. And the great British physicist Paul Davies has said that singularity represents essentially the creation of the universe before which, he calls it an extremity, before which no physical reasoning is possible. The laws of physics break down. There is no time in our sense, no space, and no matter or energy. So the universe comes out of that kind of singularity. Now, there have been some attempts to circumvent that conclusion, but I argue in the book that even those attempts have their own latent or tacit theistic implications.
Stephen, the God of the Bible has personality. Do you think this intelligent design we're talking about tonight is that kind of God?
I don't think that the evidence from nature reveals the whole of the personality of God, but it does reveal attributes of God that are consistent with that ancient Judeo-Christian perspective. After all, the very first words of the Bible are, "In the beginning." And there's a famous astrophysicist, Arno Penzias, who made with Robert Wilson one of the great discoveries of the 20th century that helped confirm the Big Bang Theory, and that is the discovery of the cosmic background radiation. Penzias is quoted as saying that the data we have are exactly what I would have predicted if I had nothing to go on but the first five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. These discoveries are consistent with the biblical perspective, but they don't reveal everything about God that you would gain from reading the holy scriptures. That's a distinction that theologians make between general and special revelation. I think nature can tell us a lot about not only that there is a designer, but the attributes of the designer, but you can't get the whole of revealed religion just from looking at the natural world.
Now let's talk about that puzzle I brought up earlier, where it seems like all these pieces fit perfectly. How in the world could that be?
Well, that has just been the growing sense I've had in working on these questions for now 35 years.
Are you baffled too?
Well, I'm currently at the Washington State in the San Juan Islands, and you go out and you see the night sky. I can see some of that beautiful Milky Way that Dr. Yeah. Skye was talking about. You see the regular concourse of the planets at night. Newton was very impressed with the exquisite balance of forces that made just our solar system possible, let alone life on our planet. In every part of the world we look, from the night sky and from the macrocosm with the galaxies and the fine-tuning of the basic parameters of physics, to the microcosm, to the inner workings of the cell, where we're now finding exquisite nanomachinery, as well as that information transmission and processing system I was talking about. In the 19th century, biologists thought that life was simple. Many physicists still thought we'd be able to explain everything by reference to a couple simple physical laws. But now everything seems to be finely balanced, finely tuned. We're in this Goldilocks zone for life in our solar system, in the universe. So I think there is a growing awareness that it could have been very much different, and we ended up in a universe with a whole propitious set of parameters that have made all the beauty and all the forms of life we see possible. There's a great physicist from Australia, Luke Barnes, who's written a book called The Fortunate Universe, emphasizing some of these same ideas.
One of the things that I have come up with in my own little theories about intelligent design, and this is as strange as it may seem, but to hear me out here, is that the designer thought of everything. And the example I cite is rain, because living plants and trees and grass and any kind of vegetation, us, we need rain to exist. You know, it's got to rain on grass or it's going to dry up and die. Who would think of this to bring water to stationary plants that can't move around and bring them the nutrients that they need to survive and the water that we need? It's an incredible design.
One of our research fellows at the Discovery Institute, the British-Australian molecular biologist Michael Denton, has written a whole book just on the unique properties of water. And he says it reveals a kind of fitness, that everything we see, many things we take for granted are perfectly fitted for the possibility of life and indeed intelligent life, and yet those parameters that we find could have easily been otherwise, such that they're it's incredibly improbable that we would live in a universe where we have where all the possibilities are constrained in just a way to make water with its exquisite properties, the parameters of our planet. There's another book by one of my colleagues, Guillermo Gonzalez, a great astronomer, called Privileged Planet, talking about the many things about planet Earth that make it a fit place for life, but also a great place for making scientific discoveries. We have this kind of convergence where the planet has many parameters that are incredibly improbable, that all turned out just right so that life could exist, but it turns out that many of those same parameters allow us to have a unique vantage point on the cosmos to discover the exquisite design in the universe.
It's exciting even just to let your mind wander and think about all this,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Going out and looking at the night sky or peering into one of those microscopes, seeing those miniature machines that we can now detect with electron micrographs. It's the macrocosm, exquisite, beautiful, orderly, and clearly designed, but the microcosm of the cell, the same.
Where do we get your book, Return of the God Hypothesis?
It's available on all the online sellers, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Indie Books, all those sorts of places. And I have a new website that our tech team at Discovery Institute has designed, returnofthegodhypothesis.com.
All right. We'll get that linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com along with your other websites. And Stephen Meyer is also on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Just put his name in there and watch it pop up. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take your phone calls about the return of the God hypothesis. Let's get your questions. Let's get your thoughts with Stephen Meyer next.